to do what other judges have done in both Canada and the United States, which in some ways is to vindicate colonialism, to say, yes, it's colonialism, but there are certain kinds of principles involved. Yes, we're not going to deal with the essential rightness of what happened, but we're not going to say that there were no rights. But all that Marshall does in the judgments, and indeed all that the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council do in the closest Canadian parallel, the St. Catharines Milling case, is to in fact vindicate or affirm the legal validity of state actions which have already occurred. Now, the state actions which have already occurred in both countries, and in both instances, it is a process of negotiating treaties between the colonial power and local tribal groups. One says, oh, right, if Marshall made things up and vindicated what had already happened, what were the roots of what had already happened? And we have required, over the last decade or so, revisionist historians to go back beyond some of the myths to try to fit it together. So I'd cite a book like Jennings' book, The Invasion of America, as one which roots the practice of signing treaties in the reality of contact between significant populations, one of which had intensive patterns of land use and the other which wanted to establish intensive patterns of land use in the same area. And it was a practical political reality which led to these patterns. Indeed, the truth was, with populations of the density of the Indian populations in New England, it was simply not possible for the numbers of Europeans to take over the area without some recognition of indigenous rights in the process. And it's that practical recognition which is affirmed later by Marshall in the famous judgments and by Canadian courts in upholding treaty-making patterns as being legally real in Canada. Right. Now, so what I suggest is that in that whole era, the question of the rights of acquisition of territory is essentially papered over. One can, however, go back to the Spanish period where the propriety of the acquisition itself was discussed. And Victoria gives certain grounds, comments on certain of the pretensions that Spain held out to justify the acquisition of territories, such as, and here indeed we get the recycling of, perhaps the first cycling of material that is recycled constantly since. You get notions that they are people can have rights, but the Indians are too stupid, to which Victoria replies that they may not be very bright, but there are a lot of Spanish peasants that don't appear much brighter, and we recognize land rights in them. Victoria does a very interesting analysis of of sort of premises of equality in terms of paganism and degree of education and these kinds of things. But that kind of analysis, and in some ways, Victoria plays a card that I think he did not anticipate the use that would be made of later. Because he said an acquisition of territory without the consent of the native people would be valid morally and legally if it was for the benefit of the tribal populations involved. In many ways, that is the seminal beginnings of the doctrine of trusteeship, not as a doctrine of benevolence to native people, but as a doctrine of justification for acquisition of territories. But it has some compromise elements in it. It says, yes, we can do it. We are apparently the ones, we Europeans are apparently the ones who can decide when it's in their benefit. But we have to justify this in our own intellectual terms, we have to say that there have got to be some standards. We can't just do whatever we want to do. But by the time we start to get some, certainly by the time we get to the period of decolonization after the First and Second World Wars, things are moving on quite different bases. You do get some holdings in international law. There are three celebrated decisions before the Western Sahara in which the rights of indigenous people lose each time. In the Island of Palmas case...
These are in the International Court of Justice, are they?
They're in varying institutions. You have, in the period between the two world wars, what is called the Permanent Court of International Justice, which commentators have said was not a court, did not dispense justice, and clearly was not permanent. But it was the predecessor of what is now the International Court of Justice, or often referred to as the World Court. You had the Isle of Palmas decision, which I don't have notes on it here. It may have been an international arbitration as opposed to a decision of the permanent court. It was. Okay, it was an international arbitration. It is normally cited for the proposition that indigenous tribes do not have status in international law. They are not recognized as nation states. You'll find that recycled in a lot of sort of orthodox, older international law materials. You have the Eastern Greenland case, and you have the Cayuga arbitration between Canada and the United and between the United Kingdom and the United States in relation to the Cayuga Indians who moved from New York State to Canada. I won't dwell on those. They all reflect the earlier colonial assumptions in which state status is denied to the tribes and international law character to treaties with indigenous tribes are denied. You find in literature, in the international law literature, a fair preoccupation with the questions of, some preoccupation with the questions of acquisition of colonial territories. And various methods of acquisition are set out, including consent. There's relatively little focus on this material anymore, and for rather good reason. It was all terribly self-justifying, and the essential point of it historically was to solve disputes between colonial powers, not relationships between colonial powers and indigenous populations. The simple point is that the reference on the Western Sahara that Tom Berger has referred to a few times over the last 3 days, decided by the International Court of Justice, really lays to rest a number of the elements of the earlier international law tradition. The Western Sahara is, of course, an area in northern Africa below Morocco. The question was Moroccan pretensions to claim it as part of Morocco and claims by indigenous populations within the area to independence, with mineral wealth being seen as a very key factor in the whole thing. The decision of the International Court of Justice, which is a very long series of judgments, is usually cited for the proposition that the doctrine of terra nullius is now finally disposed of. Terra nullius was Latin for no person's land and reflected the doctrine that you could approach a territory which was sparsely populated by migratory hunting bands and say that it didn't belong to anybody. You denied both the political and legal occupation of the land, therefore treated it as if it was vacant and therefore open to the acquisition by any power that wanted to come around and take first grabs at it. The question was whether the patterns of occupation in the Western Sahara were of such a minimal quality that they would clearly fit into terra nullius and justify this kind of acquisition. In terms of a simple comparison between the patterns of occupation there and the patterns of occupation in Aboriginal North America, it is clear that the population densities were higher here and the established patterns of land use were clearer here. Therefore, it becomes an extremely effective test of whether international law would, in retrospect, justify the acquisitions of territories in North America on any basis other than consent. The answer of the International Court of Justice was that the rights were with the local population. It was not terra nullius. It was not open to acquisition, except on the basis of consent. In many ways, what the judgment has done is to create a jurisprudential base for a modern proposition not yet completely accepted in international law, which is that colonialism is today illegal. The only way of acquisition of territory today would be by consent, which is not colonialism, but is indeed the exercise of the right of self-determination of a people, a decision by them freely to amalgamate their juridical entity with another state. That is possible. That's not colonialism. The modern law, if not established at this point, the way we're going is very clearly that colonialism is itself now illegal. One has to remember, so in terms of, this is an attempt to discuss the law on acquisition of territories as it's developed and where it is at today. That then poses a fundamental problem of legitimacy under international law for nation states like Canada and the United States and Norway and Sweden and Japan, other countries in which have either been nation states created by immigration or nation states which have expanded to incorporate in their territory areas that formerly were autonomous areas of indigenous populations.
Russia would qualify too, I take it.
Russia would qualify. You can get in, China has areas. There'd be some questions of what were the historic boundaries of China. It's something that applies to all of the regional areas of the world, and raises certain questions of the degree to which treaty arrangements in North America, for example, comprised an example of consent being given, and if it was consent, on what terms was it given? And so you do find among certain of the current activists on this issue a great concern as to whether arrangements like the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act or other modern arrangements can be interpreted in international law now as having comprised elements of consent. Consent perhaps on terms or perhaps broadly, that has now and quite recently entered into the discussions.
Is there a retroactive effect?
Well, international law is somewhat peculiar. It is not an exact parallel to national law, particularly in terms of enforceability. And perhaps because it's not exactly parallel in terms of enforceability, it's also, in some ways, in international law terminology, programmatic, as opposed to the creation of rules. It is the creation of standards or goals. So that if it was as rule-oriented as domestic law, then the answer would have to be that it could not be retroactive. Or there'd have to be something we'd have to do about retroactivity. Given that it is programmatic and goal-oriented, there is some debate in international law about the degree of retroactivity. T.O. Elias, who is one of the figures on the International Court of Justice, has written about the doctrine of intertemporal law, which is the phrase which is used for this debate within international law, and has suggested that indeed the doctrine of intertemporal law, which has bases in international decisions, says that rights previously acquired must be judged by the international law as we now understand it, and not the international law in place at the time of acquisition. Therefore, the legitimacy of prior acquisitions is put in question, because there would be no, I think there would be little doubt that early acquisitions of portions of Canada, with which I'm most familiar, would have been understood in those times to be acquisition of terra nullius lands, and therefore in compliance with doctrines of international law. Elias's view is that if that is a correct understanding of the law at that time, it is not now legitimate in international law terms.
Therefore, basis for claims, retro.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. So the present rules are retroactive. He does not spell out exactly the consequences. There are other concepts of international law which may have some bearing on this. I think he is thinking of notions of acquiescence and relying on patterns of acquiescence to long-established jurisdictional arrangements as mitigating the most radical effects of his conclusion that these rules are to be applied retroactively. But certainly, Elias is a very prominent figure in international law, and his conclusion, to state it in one sentence, is that this is to be applied retroactively.
Is he a member of the World Court?
Yes.
From what country?
I believe from Nigeria.
How many judges sat on the Western Sahara case in 1975?
I'm sorry, I don't know the number offhand. They sit large panels, and there are quite a number of judgments.
Usually 15, I think.
Yes.
Sorry, carry on.
Okay. That was, this portion was on the issue in international law of the acquisition of territories. We can wind up with international law posing the problem that there is no international law explanation for legitimacy of many of these acquisitions. Nevertheless, we have a reality of acquisition having occurred. Let me turn to the international law on decolonization. International law on decolonization is more recent than most people think. There was no principle of decolonization established after the First World War, nor was there one established after the Second World War with the establishment of the United Nations. It was still not possible at that point. What you had after both World Wars was the taking of colonies from defeated powers and bringing them under some formal international system of supervision and determination of their future course. Because it was only of defeated powers, it did not represent any beginning or articulation of first principles. The modern law of decolonization is seen as focusing on the 1960 Declaration of the General Assembly. And so to turn to basic general source documents, that's the one. The question of decolonization has not been handled simply in the context of whether acquisition was legitimate. To just use an example to make that point, Fiji is one of the examples of acquisition of a territory by consent, by a treaty of cession, without going into any question as to whether the treaty could have been challengeable. You did have tribal authorities on Fiji voluntarily, apparently, accept British control over the island. However, in the period of decolonization since the Second World War, the question has tended to be more whether this population was a people with a right of self-determination, rather than the question whether this territory had been acquired validly by the United Kingdom. And so Fiji was decolonized and became independent without any judgment being passed on the question of acquisition. So it may be that the whole issue of the status of indigenous peoples can simply be approached not from the question of initial legitimacy of acquisition, but from the question as to whether the principles of self-determination of peoples, which Bernard Nietschmann referred to, apply to these populations. That is the general tenor of decolonization since 1960. Okay. Now, we still had the situation that international law was in the hands of the other guys, and so there were clear doctrines which were developed to limit the right of self-determination of peoples. One is often referred to as the saltwater or blue water theory, which is that decolonization refers to a separate colony. It applies to British colonies in Africa or French colonies in Asia or Dutch colonies in Indonesia, these kinds of things. They're obviously colonies. The color of the skin is different, and there's often a tremendous amount of salt water between the metropolitan country and the colony. That's one reason, I think, why Alaska may have been somewhat troubling, because it was not contiguous. And the Irish have a wonderful folk song in which they praise the sea. Thank God for the sea, the beautiful blue sea. If it weren't for the sea, Ireland never would be free. So this was a protective measure. The other way of stating the same kind of proposition was that the right of self-determination of peoples did not allow the splitting up of a national territory. It seemed to be that if you had a contiguous territory, there was an assumption that you could not have a right of self-determination which would splinter that contiguity. There were a couple of other ways in which that was...
Could you give us an example of that?
We have one rather close at home, which was Quebec in Canada. The Quebec nationalists argued that they were a separate people with a right of self-determination under international law. There were various ways that Canada responded to that, one of which was that you're a minority, not a people. Another was that you're contiguous, and the doctrine of self-determination does not allow for the splitting up of national territory. And a third was the once-only theory, that Canada had gained its independence from the United Kingdom, and the French, however happily, had come along with us, and they were stuck with the marriage. In this kind of context, international law did not permit divorce. This sort of constellation of arguments meant that a right of an indigenous population to self-determination was denied by one of a combination of these kinds of arguments. However, the earlier statements of the right of self-determination of peoples in international instruments tended to be guarded and tended to be linked always with a reiteration of the principle of not breaking up national territory. But over the last sort of 15 years, the restatements of the right of self-determination of peoples have come out without the qualifications being specified. Not that they have been explicitly denounced, but that they are no longer restated, so that in the two international human rights conventions, which Bernard Nietschmann referred to, which were the texts of which were approved by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1966, the first article of both of those is an unqualified statement of the right of peoples to self-determination. Those are the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. In the United States, there's some problems with these documents because the United States does not sign international human rights documents. They have not signed either of those. They have not even signed the International Convention Against Genocide, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, which is the most widely adhered to of the post-World War II human rights conventions at the international level, has also not been adhered to by the United States. The
You're using adherence in the formal sense of agreeing to be bound by it.
These documents, as international legislation, are only binding on states which sign them. Yeah. They are in the form of treaties. This is what is called conventional international law, that is, the international law created by treaties or conventions, which is only binding on the nation states which sign them. The United States has a surprising, given its pretensions on human rights questions, has an amazingly uniform record at the international and even regional levels of signing nothing at all. One of the reasons that the Helsinki Accords feature so much in U.S. discussions of human rights and U.S. accusations of human rights violations on the part of the Soviet Union is it's about the only thing that the United States has ever signed. It happens to be something that the Soviet Union signed as well, because the impetus of the whole Helsinki Accords was to settle the post-war boundaries and security questions in Europe. The Helsinki Accords are not UN. The whole process was outside of the United Nations. But there are human rights provisions which were included. But if you move into international covenants under UN auspices or international human rights agreements under the auspices or parallel to the Organization of American States, as Sandy Davis will no doubt indicate, the United States has not adhered to the Inter-American Convention on human rights. Yes.
But
Henry Hsu, just for the record.
I just wanted to raise a question. There is the argument that the failure to become a signatory does not mean that the U.S. is not bound. One version of it is that this is such widely accepted conventional law that it now has the status of customary law, and so on. I just wonder if you'd comment on, because you're sort of letting the U.S. Completely off the hook.
Well, I hadn't realized I was letting them off the hook. I thought I was being somewhat unfriendly as an alien within the borders, but international law is divided into two broad categories. Customary international law, which is the creation of treaties and conventions, and therefore created by the formal consent of the nation states involved. The other body of international law, as Henry Hsu has indicated, is customary international law, and the doctrine on this in domestic United States law, as it is in much of the common law tradition countries, is that customary international law is automatically a part of the domestic legal system unless it is in conflict with explicit legislation within the country. And there have been some recent rulings in the United States confirming this tradition. The De La Tiga case, if I've got the name right, Filartica case, has confirmed this and has been the subject of considerable comment within the U.S. Legal system. Therefore, some of the elements, I mean, in that you had a ruling by a United States court that torture by a state was now so broadly accepted at the international level as a violation of human rights that it had become an element of customary international law and had therefore become incorporated within the domestic law of the United States. So that is a rooting for this international law material to gain formal recognition within the legal system of the United States. The principle, therefore, of the self-determination of peoples could, without any trouble, it seems to me, be stated at this point to be an extremely widely adhered to principle in international law. It certainly appears in so many major documents, declarations of the General Assembly and international conventions, that I would assume there would be very little difficulty in arguing, even within the framework of a United States domestic court, that it has attained the status as being a rule of customary international law, which then takes us to a second stage of this analysis, which is what is the content of the right of self-determination of a people. The phrase has been associated with the development of the formal law of decolonization in the period since the Second World War, and therefore has the connotation for most people of full formal decolonization, with the emergence of the people as an independent nation state recognized as such by the other nation states. There has been a body of argument developed quite recently for different or a broader possible content to the right of self-determination of peoples, that indeed it could have a, quote, domestic content in the sense that it need not represent a complete breach of the juridical unity of the nation state, but nevertheless be something recognized by international law and therefore in effect be a right of a group within a nation state to a degree of self-determination appropriate to the grouping, which would be recognized both in the domestic legal system and at the international level. Now, statements internationally on this have been to date quite cautious. Madam Erika Dias of Greece, who is their representative on the commission, on the subcommission on the prevention of discrimination and the protection of minorities, which is a subcommission of the Commission of Human Rights of the United Nations, Madam Erika Dias was appointed by the subcommission to be the chairperson of the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, which now meets every year in Geneva. At a speech at an international law conference on minority rights in Quebec City last week, she gave a speech in which she stated that in her view, the principle of self-determination of peoples applied to indigenous populations in a non-secessionist context, was the way in which she put it. Therefore, this was, to my mind, a very significant statement by Madame Dias, along the lines that it seemed to me very clearly we had been moving in at international law, but in all fairness, I would have had to have said, I would and would still say, is not a settled question in international law. Now, if I can move away from that for a moment. This is the second part of my comments, which dealt with decolonization in the present law and the significance of self-determination of peoples.
Doug, could I just interrupt you for a moment? I think we're all getting an awful lot out of this. It's fairly densely packed, at least.
And my voice is running out.
But I wonder if we could just in a moment break for coffee and then let Doug resume while we catch our breath. And when Doug finishes his presentation, I'd like to call on Lewis Hanke to make any observations he thinks appropriate, since he will be leaving tonight. And after that, Clem Cherche, who will be leaving tonight, and then we'll turn to Sandy and Henry Hsu. But would you mind if we took a 5-minute break for coffee? And I think this is being masterfully done, really.
It's available public information.
I'm glad we recruited you guys.
Is this a distinction which you did on the first session? So it's kind of updating this, working with AI.
It's the basic material thing.
Well, maybe we should be seated. We'll start again, let me just say that I'm eager to continue and complete the discussion that we're into now. But I'm being a little selfish about this. I think this discussion on recent developments in international law may be especially helpful to me, and I'm the one who's supposed to write a report, so that's why I'm trying to keep the discussion going here. We'll call on Doug and then on Louis Hanke and Clem Chartier to start things rolling. And I thought that tomorrow morning, if this discussion is not yet completed, we'll carry on with it. But Robert Goldwyn suggested to me that it might be useful tomorrow, since we're going to be here, to perhaps ask the educators. Dennis Demert will be back. We have Raina and Verna and Oscar here to perhaps indicate for us the criteria or the standards that they feel an educator and guard as well. The criteria or the standards that an educational system ought to meet if it is fairly to present the history of Native peoples, not only to Native students, but to non-Native students. And I put that out for your consideration. Robert suggested that it might, if we succeeded in doing that tomorrow, we might then set out the criteria for self-determination within a nation state. Those two tasks might very well keep us here for 2 years, but let's think about it overnight. And maybe we could take a shot at it tomorrow. Let's just see. All right, Doug, please continue.
Okay, I'll try to finish somewhat briefly. The third area that I thought should be covered was the development of the international law of human rights in the period since the Second World War. There had been an extremely limited development of an international law on minority rights in the period between the First and Second World Wars, which was seen as a failure and was not something that was built on in the period after the Second World War. The United Nations Charter stated a goal of the promotion of human rights and fundamental freedoms, and on the formation of the United Nations, a major project was the drafting of an International Bill of Rights. That took the form in the end of three documents: the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which as a declaration of the General Assembly was not technically binding in international law, although potentially a source of customary international law. The two other parts of the International Bill of Rights were the two human rights covenants, which I've mentioned before and which Bernard Nietschmann mentioned, which the texts of which were approved by the General Assembly in 1966, which came into force with sufficient state signatories in 1976. In the structure of the United Nations, the issue of human rights is by the Charter assigned to the Economic and Social Council, and the Human Rights Commission was established responsible to the Economic and Social Council. Under that body, there was a mandate in the Charter for the establishment of bodies concerned with minority rights and discrimination. Rather than establishing two bodies, only one was established: the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities. The fact that minority rights did not...
What was the other one? It wasn't established.
Two were supposed to be established, one concerned with minority rights and a second one concerned with discrimination.
And the first wasn't established.
Instead of establishing two, they established one with a mandate for both.
Yeah, all right.
It's called the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities. the significance of that organizational change was what it meant in relation to minority rights. It was impossible to accomplish anything on minority rights questions in the context of the United Nations for at least the first decade of the organization. And so while you had considerable work in the area of discrimination, and particularly racial discrimination, minority rights were essentially a taboo subject for a number of reasons. Gain writers suggest that the United States, with its individual rights orientation, played a role in this, in the melting pot ideology most often associated with the United States. Also, the views of third world countries emerging from colonialism also are seen as playing a role in this, because they were tremendously concerned with national integration and were not interested in rights of subgroups within their nation states. There are other factors which are attributed as well, which I won't go into at this moment. The first breakthrough on minority rights was Article 27 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, approved by the General Assembly as part of the covenant in 1966. It casts minority rights in terms of individual rights. And Article 27 says that individuals who are members of ethnic, religious, and linguistic minorities have the right to practice their religion, speak their language, and live their culture in community with other members of their group. The thinking, and there are people at the international level who will deny that this is a minority rights section. A tension is perceived between individual rights and collective rights. A fear is involved that if minority rights are recognized as the rights of collectivities, then international law has now recognized collective rights, collectivities at a sub-state level. If I can back up for a moment, traditionally international law was the law of relations between nation states, and individuals had no role in or standing in international law. The development of the international law of human rights on an individualistic basis was a breach of that tradition, the recognition of individuals as having certain rights directly under international law. But to move to collective groupings, less than nation states and more than individuals, is an area in which there's been painful and minuscule development. In the context, and I'd be interested, Henry Hsu might be interested at some point in commenting on the widespread perception that there is a natural tension between the idea of individual rights and the idea of group rights. It seems to me that that is spurious, but it seems to me to be fairly widespread as an articulated concern. In terms of the international law of human rights, you had the development of certain international forums. Initially, with the creation of the UN, there was no mechanism for non-state groupings to have an international adjudication. The International Court of Justice would only hear from nation states, and that remains true today, although nation states can refer to the International Court of Justice questions which involve the rights of groups other than recognized nation states. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights has created an international forum, the Human Rights Committee, with an adjudicatory power for some states which have signed what is referred to as the optional protocol, which allows that procedure. We have this slow development of institutions with technical competency and recognized adjudicatory roles. Again, I would note that the United States is outside of this development, but since it is a signatory to the United Nations Charter, which itself is a treaty, it is associated with the major organs of the United States, such as the Commission and the Subcommission. It was in the context of the human rights law relating to racial discrimination that a specific concern with indigenous populations arose. A special rapporteur's study was commissioned by the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities on the question of racial discrimination. In around 1970 or 1971, the rapporteur in a preliminary report said to the Subcommission that the situation of indigenous populations was a special, separate situation which merited an independent investigation and recommended that such an investigation take place. A special study was commissioned by the Subcommission, the COBO study, which was completed last year. So there is now at the UN level a study on, under the title Discrimination Against Indigenous Populations, plus a special body, the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, which is under the Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities. Both of these, the institution and the report, are in United Nations terminology aimed at the development of standards in international law relating to the treatment of indigenous populations. It is assumed by many who are involved in this that the development will take the following steps, that there will be the preparation of a declaration which will set out certain standards, which will go to the General Assembly to be adopted at that level. Therefore, that will be a declaration, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which can set standards and have influence on customary international law, but which is not in itself a binding part of international law. Many who are involved anticipate going on to a second stage in which a convention is developed, a treaty which would articulate standards, which would then be binding as a matter of international law on the nation states which were signatories to it. These developments have occurred within the context of human rights, not in the context of decolonization. Nevertheless, the boundaries between human rights as individual